Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee. Okay, so this week we talk about emotions and intellect, mind and heart. You know, the Wizard of Oz, there were a few characters. One needed a brain, right? Is this correct? It's been a while. It's been a really long time. They only had a brain. One guy needed a heart. And what there were
courage.
Courage. Is that different than heart? What was the heart guy?
The Tin Man.
Okay. All right. So I don't think we're going to talk about courage today. Maybe we will. We'll see. I don't know. I'm not brave enough to talk about that subject yet. But today we're going to talk about the mind-heart duality. What is the mind? What is the heart? What distinguishes intellect from emotions? And what is it? And what does it mean for us? How is it connected with the cosmic fabric of the universe and the purpose of all of creation? So let's begin by exploring the differences between the mind and the heart. So I'll turn the discussion to you and ask you the question, what distinguishes intellect from emotions? Intellect from emotions. What's the difference between an idea or between the mind and the heart? There's no wrong answer. But of course, there's the answer that I'm looking for. I'm kidding.
Logic versus passion.
Huh?
Logic versus passion.
Good. What else?
The heart reacts to your intellect. Your heart reacts to your emotions.
Your heart reacts to your emotions. Okay, good. And versus intellect?
Well,
what would the distinction be?
Intellect versus the heart?
Yeah. In other words, the heart is reactive, and the mind maybe is proactive, rational. Okay. Good. What else? Remember, there's no wrong answer.
Well, I just heard this study that I can't remember who did it, and they were testing to see whether the brain responded or the heart responded first.
Interesting.
The heart was responding before the brain. And I'm sorry, it's very vague. I'll brush up.
But to what? Like,
right, that's what I wanted to get.
Was it to specific stimuli or whatever?
It sounds great.
I think even in its more mysterious state, it's good. Right? I mean, it's because it opens up a discussion about, you know, how do we lead? Do we lead with the mind? Do we lead with the heart? I think we know people that are more, we would call them more intellectual, more calculated. They're more, you know, methodical on that, you know, thought out and planned. There are people that lead more with their heart on their sleeve, more reactive and more, you know, just that type of emotion-centric personality. One way, Kabbalah speaks about the mind and the heart and that duality so many different places, and there are many details, and a lot of the details that we've spoken about already are discussed and explored and explained in Kabbalah. But one point that I want to mention that is also discussed in Kabbalah is that the mind, start with the heart is subjective, and the mind, hopefully, is objective. In other words, the heart almost by its definition, is how I feel. How do I feel about something? It's very subjective. This made me feel a certain way. I like this, I don't like that. You know, I'm attracted to this, I'm not attracted to that. Very subjective. Very subjective. You know, as many different people as there are different emotional temperatures. In contrast, the idea of intellect, ideally, is to be objective. It's to understand a thing as it is. So anyone, if you've ever studied in a yeshiva, you'll know that the discussion is always, what is the Talmud trying to say? It's not, how do I understand the Talmud? It's, what is the Talmud trying to say? Let's understand what it's trying to say. How do I feel about it? That I'll figure out later. But what is it trying to say? What is Rashi's commentary adding to the verse that I didn't know before? What's Rashi saying? What is, as you're always analyzing the idea to try to understand the idea as the idea is. Now, I don't mean to say that everyone understands things the same way, because it's purely objective, so everyone has the same ideas about things. Of course not. But intelligence, intellect, in its purest form, is about objectivity. It's about understanding a thing as it is, not feeling it as you are. So feelings, in Kabbalah, feelings, emotions, are subjective, and intellect, the mind, is objective. That's one way, amongst many, that's one way to differentiate between the mind and the heart. Now, if you understand something in a subjective way, if you understand something very much, well, this is how I understand it, not how you understand it, Kabbalah would say, what's happening? Maybe you can help me out. What's happening? What do you think is happening in that situation? If the mind is objective and the heart is subjective, and now you're understanding something in a subjective way, so what's happening? What's the conclusion? Your heart is influencing your mind, which is possible. Your mind can influence your heart. Your heart can also influence your mind. Of course, right? Anyone that's ever justified negative behavior has seen this firsthand, right? We justify negative behavior. We come up with rationalizations. What is a rationalization? It's the mind being influenced by the emotions, by the heart, to do mental acrobatics in a very subjective way. In other words, like one of my favorite examples about the fellow who is always, might as well go through the whole story, even though many of you have heard it a million times. There's a king who loves archery, who's traveling through a forest for the first time in a certain land, and he sees on every tree in the forest, he sees a bullseye and an arrow dead center in the middle of the bullseye. And he says, who is this archer? Who is this magic archer that is so amazing? No one is this good. So he asks around. It turns out it's a young teenager who practices archery. He says, I must meet this young man. He meets the young man. And he says, tell me, how do you do it? What's your secret? And the young man says, it's simple. I shoot the arrow at the tree, and wherever it lands, I draw the bullseye around it. Super simple. Sorry, bad timing with the coffee over there. Super simple, right? You shoot the arrow, wherever it lands, boom, that's exactly where we wanted it. Sometimes, that's how we use the mind. What do I mean to say? We have a certain feeling about something. We want a certain outcome. We have a certain subjectivity about what and how and where something should be, whatever. And then we use the mind as the arrow to shoot an idea. No, sorry. That's the arrow, whatever. And then we use the mind, there we go, to draw the circle around it and say, you see, and that's why it makes sense also.
Justify it.
Huh?
Justify it.
That is the mind in a non-objective state. In other words, that's not pure mind. That's not pure intellect. That is mind being influenced and guided by the heart. Which, it is what it is, but it's not pure mind. In other words, what I'm trying to say is, although Kabbalah says that intellect is objective and emotions are subjective, it doesn't mean that all ideas are objective. You can, and that when people say things and justify things, it's always objective. It could be very subjective. But then you should know that what's happening here is, if you know that the mind is objective and the heart is subjective, if the mind is ever subjective, it means because the heart has infiltrated the mind. It's taken over the mind, and now your mind is being led by your subjective emotions, your feelings. So because you feel a certain way, you're excited about something, you're afraid of something, or you want something, or you don't want something, so the mind is doing its incredible mental acrobatics to explain why this makes sense, even objectively, but of course it's not at all objective. But in its purest state, the mind is objective. That's one of the greatest gifts that we have. Now, the heart being subjective is also a great gift. It's not a bad thing. It could lead to a bad thing. The mind that's objective could also lead to a bad thing. Let's explain. A heart that's objective is good because it's you. It's how you feel. It's how you experience the world. And that's different than anyone else. No one has ever walked through the world and had the same experiences as you. Even if two people, which is impossible, but even if two people theoretically have the same footprints, the same path, literally, like the foot, like if you mapped it, treaded the same spaces, exactly the same, you know, the same roots in life, it would still be different. Again, that's never happened, I'm sure. Number one. Number two, even if it would happen, it would still be not at all mean that two people therefore shared the same experiences, because everyone, each individual that experiences something is even if it's the same thing, experiences it differently based on their subjective emotional disposition. So because emotions are so personal, it's about who am I, who I am, it's how I feel. It's how I interpret life. It's how I react to life. That's what emotions are. So it gives us, that is really what makes up our individuality. And it's a beautiful blessing. At the same time, it also could be dangerous. It's dangerous because it can lead to a lot of disunity. It could lead to a lot of fighting. It could lead to a lot of misunderstanding. Well, this is how I feel. I don't agree with you. I don't feel like you feel, and you feel differently, and therefore I don't like you. Right? It can lead to a lot of fragmentation amongst people because it's so subjective. So on the one hand, it's an incredible blessing because it defines our unique individuality, which is a good thing. On the other hand, by definition, individuality means distinction from others, which also could lead to splitting off from others, friction. So those are the pros and cons of emotions, of the heart. Let's talk about the pros and cons of the mind. So the pro of the mind being objective is, it's pure. It's untainted by the subjectivity of the heart, ideally, right? It can analyze something, it can understand something the way it is. Objective. Clarity. My heart is so confused. How do I feel? I don't know how I feel sometimes. But my mind, ideally, you know, on a pure level, my mind can tell me the truth about that thing, as long as it's not being too much influenced by my heart. So that's the pro of the mind. That's the positive, the virtue of the mind. What is the challenge of the mind? The challenge of the mind is being so objective is a challenge. Because it can lead us to become very cold and calculating to others. It can lead us to become so indifferent to another person's pain, another person's joy, another person's, you know, hardship, whatever it is. So if I'm stuck in my mind, in my objective mind, and I say, look, this is right, and this is wrong, and this is the way things should be, and I'm in a world of almost ideals, so then maybe I'm less caring, I'm less, you know, I'm less heart, I'm less feeling toward another. And so that can be a drawback of the mind. So each one has an advantage and a disadvantage, or maybe many advantages and many disadvantages, because both are unique. And each of us has a mind, and we each have a heart, and the reality is it's with the combination of the two, and that's what makes us human. We have a piece of objectivity, piece of subjectivity, and together, hopefully, it rounds us out as human beings. We can be objective about things and understand things and see things the way they are. We can feel things, you know, we can be passionate about things. It's this duality, it's this mix that makes us human beings. So far, so good. Make sense? Yes?
An adjunct to the heart, maybe known as something before the brain does, when system shuts down and we don't function as we would otherwise. So that's as if they would be working in tandem, where there might be a little brain in the heart and a little heart.
Yeah. Kabbalah says that. Now, you know, when we talk about brain and heart, is it literally heart? Does the heart really know? Does the heart have it? These are words that we use, and there is accuracy on some level with these words. On the other hand, it's more of intellect and emotions, and you know, when we are emotive, the heart does react. You know, you can measure that in the heart. But Kabbalah does speak about mochin shebimidot, the intelligence in the heart, and midot shebimochin, and emotions in the mind. It speaks about that crossover. It's a very fluid relationship, but in its purest state, one is this and the other is that. Each one has its own place, and there's an advantage of the commingling of them, of the two. There's an advantage of them retaining their pure identity. We all need to be objective sometimes. It's healthy to have the capacity to be objective and not be emotionally caught up in something to the point where you can't see truth. It's like, I'm so stuck in the way I feel that I can't see what's right. That's not healthy. At the same time, to be dispassionate about things because I'm so cold and calculating and intellectual that I can only see things purely objectively and I don't feel anything to myself, to my loved ones, to the stranger, to anybody else, that's also not healthy. You need both. We need the objectivity and the subjectivity.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating that scientists have recently discovered actual brain cells in the heart.
That's pretty cool.
They're histologically, when you look at cells in a microscope, they're different. And there are actual brain cells in the heart.
Fascinating. I think as more studies come out, you know, we'll discover more of these things. Listen, it's fascinating. Look, Kabbalah speaks of the truth of the human reality from the inside out. In other words, from a truth perspective. This is divine wisdom, and this is the way the human being is created. This is almost manufacturers' insights into the product, right? This is how the system is built. Science is figuring out stuff from the almost the outside in. Like, we're looking at things from the outside and trying to say, okay, so what's inside? I think the more we get inside, the more we'll see these truths reflected. But I think we all know this. We all know that we have the capacity to be objective. We have a capacity to be subjective. We have the capacity to understand things. You have the capacity to feel things. Hey guys, welcome. What's like Spock?
Spock was half human, half goldfish.
Ah.
I think the lack of human emotion in the show is all about the food.
Interesting.
There's a lot of Kabbalah in Star Trek.
So I feel like I need to be more into Star Trek. I'm not into it. The Kabbalah of Star Trek. Is this Star Trek where they do this?
Yes.
This is the Kohen blessing. For all those listening on the podcast, it's
really
the old splitting the hand into sections of fingers. That's how the priests give their priestly blessing.
Wow.
Leonard Nimoy
is Jewish.
I think he was a Kohen.
I don't know.
Who
that.
would have learned this blessing technique from his father, passed down all the generations. That's the blessing as the priests bless the congregation. So they stand under the talit, under the prayer shawl. They put their hands like this, and then they put it together to create five channels and pathways, and that's the blessing.
Live long and prosper.
Which is Yivarecha Hashem V'Yishmarecha, which is the priestly benediction.
Is he still alive?
Leonard Nimoy, I think, passed away. Yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of Jewish themes in stuff. It does not surprise me at all. Yeah, we should do one time the class, the Kabbalah of the Matrix. I mean, we could have a whole series on that as well. Anyway, but I think for all of us, these things should resonate. We have the ability to understand things and be objective, and that's in the mind. We have the capacity, we have the ability to be subjective and to feel things our own unique way, in a way that no one else will feel, that no one can understand how I feel, right? That's the subjectivity of the heart. Let's develop this a little bit further. And I want to go back before creation, before our reality. Kabbalah teaches, and it's actually hinted in the opening verses of Genesis, of the Torah. Kabbalah teaches that there was a world of chaos that preceded our world, our reality of tikkun, of repair. The world of chaos is called tohu, not tofu. It's something else. Tohu. In English, T-O-H-U. Tohu. Tohu means chaos. The Torah, it says, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, and the earth was, va'aretz, haita was, tohu va'vohu, chaos and void. That's what it says. So the Kabbalists say, prior to creation, what was the reality, what was the status, or what existed? Chaos. From the chaos, God created order. And that's the world of tikkun, the world of repair. And of course, many know the phrase tikkun olam, repairing the world. That comes from this Kabbalistic idea, as we'll explain. What is the world of chaos? Why is it so chaotic? Kabbalists say that it was so chaotic that the world exploded. The world shattered. That reality of creation, that world of chaos, blew up. And the shards, the fragments of that reality, are now embedded deep within our tikkun, our orderly reality. And those are the sparks and fragments of holiness that we are meant to seek out and actually repair and put back together again. Remember the story of Humpty Dumpty? He sat on a wall. He had a great fall. All of the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
Because he was an egg.
Huh?
Because he was an egg.
Because he was an egg.
Also, how would a horse put together an egg?
That's actually probably the most... That's the best question I've heard in a lot. That's a really good question. I've never thought of that question. That's a fantastic question.
What was so special about Humpty Dumpty that they needed to put him back together?
Yeah. What is it? Who made it? But he's the only egg that needs to put back. Seriously. You don't see anyone else complaining, Mr. Humpty Dumpty. Since when do we name the eggs anyway? What's up with that?
Maybe it was like a giant man egg.
And then how did that happen? Like, where does that... Anyway, my point is that unlike Humpty Dumpty, that the horses couldn't put him back together again, and the king's men. Our task, the Kabbalists explain, is to fix the broken pieces. First of all, to find the broken pieces, the broken shards, reclaim them, and put them back together again. And that is called tikkun olam. That is called repairing the world. You may have heard the phrase tikkun olam, repairing the world, in many different contexts. Many different causes today, Jewish causes, other causes, will use the phrase, this is in repairing the world, and on one level it's absolutely true. But you should know that the origins of this come from the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, who lived in the 1500s in Tzfat and Safed, Israel, who was the creator, the founder, who taught what we know today as Luriana Kabbalah, named after his last name, Luriana Kabbalah. And in this school of Kabbalistic thought, the world has these broken pieces, and it's our job to find them and to fix them. Where did these broken pieces come from? The world of tohu, the world of chaos. The world of chaos is a world, is a reality that could not, that was unstable. You know, you have experiments where they put together things and it creates an instability in the mixture, and it's volatile. God created first a volatile state of existence. It's Olam HaTohu, the world of Tohu, the world of chaos. It was volatile. It was not stable. Imagine whatever instability you want to picture. I'm picturing something bubbling, like the old volcano. You know, you mix the thing and the thing, or you put the Mentos in the Coke or whatever it is. Remember that?
Yeah.
That was fun. Fun for the whole family. A little messy, but fun. So, instability. The world of chaos is a world of instability. And the world, and that reality shatters. What was unstable about it? Why did God create it so unstable? Was it a mistake? Was God experimenting with creation and he mixed things together and it didn't work out and he's like, we've tweaked the formula. We're creation 2.0. Better than ever. Stable world. Like, what's going on here? Kabbalah says, of course it wasn't a mistake. It was all intentional. But what's at the heart of it? The world of chaos, the world of Tohu, is defined, not surprisingly perhaps, by the emotions. We know that that there are 10 building blocks of creation, known as the 10 Sefirot. 10 Sefirot are 10 divine emanations. The first three are intellectual. The last seven are emotional. The world of chaos, the world of Tohu, was built on the emotions, the emotional attributes. And one thing about the emotional attributes that we know is that they are, what do we know today? They are, help me out here. What was the word that we used about the emotions?
Subjective.
Subjective. What does it mean that it's subjective? It's very individual. It's very unique. This is how I feel, and that's not how I feel. I don't feel like that. I feel like this. Emotions, pure emotions, are so subjective that they can't even tolerate another emotion. Love, pure love, doesn't tolerate pure discipline. Chesed and Gvura cannot coexist. Pure chesed, which is pure loving kindness giving, cannot tolerate pure Gvura, which is withholding and restraint. Now, a human being has the capacity to blend the two with their mind. That's introducing the objectivity and the mind into the mix. But pure emotions, pure raw emotions are so subjective, so powerful, so individualized and distinct that they can't even tolerate a neighboring emotion in the same heart. This is all when it comes to the human being. So pure love that you have doesn't tolerate pure discipline that you have, etc. There's seven emotional temperaments that every person has based on the seven emotional attributes that God projected into creating the universe. But here's the relevant information. The world of Tohu, the world of chaos, was built on these seven emotional attributes, which are, in their purest state, absolutely distinct and therefore absolutely chaotic. They're chaotic because each one in its pure max state, 100% love, 100% discipline, each emotion turned up to 100% will bump against the other person. Bump against the other emotion. Think about this. I'll give you a simple example with different people. You have a parent that thinks, two parents. One parent thinks that the best way to raise this child is with pure love and understanding and whatever the child wants, we'll give the child. Pure, 100%. 100% love, giving, loving kindness, giving, chesed. The other parent feels like rules. Healthy child needs rules and discipline and, you know, consequences, 100%. Dial it up, not 50%, not 20%, not 80%, 100%. Dial both up. You think it's going to work out?
No.
Of course not. The only way it's going to work out if parents have a different emotional disposition is if there is a compromise. We'll do some love. Huh? Not necessarily. Not necessarily. You could, well, you're saying if there was 100% each way. Yeah. The point is the only way this will work is if each one will dial it down. Right? Okay. I'm leading with love first, but I'm going to dial it down because I recognize the value of rules and discipline as well. So I'm going to make room for that neighboring emotion. And the other is going to say, I believe in discipline, but I'm going to dial it down because, you know what? A child can't just hear rules. They also have to hear, I love you. So we need both, and therefore we need to dial both down. So if you have the mixer board, right? So instead of putting both volumes 100%, it's not going to work out. You dial each one down, and now maybe you can have communication between the parents and the child, and this could work, possibly. But 100%? No one's going to compromise. No one's going to back down. 100% love, 100% discipline, it's not going to work out. The child, it's not going to work out for the child. It's not going to work out for the parents themselves. It's not going to work out. The world of chaos, the world of tohu, is a world where there were 70 emotions, emotional attributes of God, in the fabric of that creation. Each one of the seven were dialed up 100%, and it couldn't be sustained. It just could not be sustained. It was too volatile. So Kabbalah says, what happened? What happened is the world, that reality, shatters. It absolutely shatters. And the fragments become embedded into the next reality. What's the next reality? Our reality. What is the world of tikkun, the world of repair? It is marked not by emotion, but by intellect. The world of tikkun is a world in which intellect, at least potentially, reigns supreme. I don't mean to say that in the world that we find ourselves in, people are always thinking before they're reacting, and that there is no chaos in our world because everyone is seeing the truth and understanding the way things truly are. Of course I'm not saying that, because that's not the reality. The reality is that emotions sometimes do get the better of us and create chaotic results. That is certainly true. But what I am saying is that our world does have a strong measure of the intellectual attributes, intellectual powers, so that we can temper the emotions, understanding with the mind that objectively it's better to dial down the emotion and to coexist than to dial it up and break apart. That is an objective way of looking at things. An objective way, a mindful way of understanding things is, it's better to have peace and coexistence by dialing down the emotions than going 100% and having chaos and volatility. Does that make sense? And yet, there is a lot of power, a raw power in the volatility. Somebody who is seized by emotion, it's very powerful. Somebody seized by intellect, very calm. Not always, but you think about someone who's very much an intellectual. Someone who's seized by emotion, 100% emotion in that moment, whatever the emotion is, love, anger, whatever. Wow, it's chaotic energy. It's a lot of energy. It's a massive amount of energy. 100% intellect. What are they doing? Writing a lot of formulas on the board. Unless there's emotion there also. But understand that emotions and intellect are totally different. The truly powerful things in this world, powerful sparks, powerful light in this world, are emanating from that world of chaos that broke apart. That world that shattered, not by accident, it was by divine plan. It's implanting, embedding in the fabric of this world of repair that we're working on repairing, this tikkun reality, powerful light, powerful godly lights in sometimes the darkest of spaces. It's the remnants, not the remnants, the actual pieces, so to speak, of divine light from the world of chaos that are embedded in this world that we're meant to extract. So when we encounter something chaotic, something powerful, something severely challenging, you know that it's coming from the world of chaos. And it's meant to be approached mindfully and transformed, and the energy is meant to be leveraged for something divine. So that's how Kabbalah explains the interplay between the world of chaos that preceded the world of repair and what our task here on this earth is, which is to repair those shards of chaos. So chaos, the world of chaos, has great light. Because of the great light, the vessel shattered. Kabbalah uses the language of light and vessel. Light and vessel is obviously metaphoric, it's not literal, but if we wanted to use the metaphor in a tangible way, imagine a cup, imagine a very fragile cup, crystal glass, that you take a fire hose and you try to fill it up with water. What's going to happen is, obviously, the glass will shatter. So not only are you not going to have the water contained in the glass, you're now going to have a broken glass, broken pieces of glass. The world of chaos is the light of the emotions that were the fabric of that creation were too powerful for the vessels, for the container of that world, and so everything shattered. Our world, which is built on the intellect, the intelligence, the mindfulness, that's at least the foundation of this reality. Our world has broad vessels, bigger vessels, and not so much light. The light is embedded, is hidden, and our job is to find the light and bring that big light into the larger vessels. So that's all the Kabbalistic interplay of the world of Tohu and the world of Tikkun, the world of chaos, and the world of repair. Again, it's all highlighting this same truth about intellect and emotions. The mind is objective. The heart is subjective. The mind unifies and brings together. The heart divides and splits apart. It splits apart within itself. Each emotion pushes away the other emotion. I have love. I have discipline. I'm not like you. I'm not like you. Right? Each emotion pushes away. And also, it can push away the other person. Right? When you feel passionately emotionally one way, and if someone else feels passionately emotionally, whatever, very passionate about an emotion the other way, it can drive people apart. So again, the mind is objective and it also unifies. The heart is subjective and it can split and divide. Yeah, not always. It usually ends up in a fight. Usually ends up in conflict. They negate each other, but maybe in a different way than you mean. They negate each other in a way that's trying to destroy each other. It creates a divide. Another way to understand this, another example that Kabbalah uses is the difference between water and fire. Intellect. The mind is like water, emotions, and the heart, they're like fire. Water and fire. What's the difference between water and fire? Water combines, fire divides. Think about it. You take a piece of paper, the paper has form, structure, it has length, it has length, width, breadth, it's a thickness, it has a structure. You take a fire, you take a match, and you light the paper on fire. What happens? It burns, and it leaves ashes. And what happens? You've disintegrated its form. It had structure, it had form, and you've broken it. Right? It's like you take a twig, and you break it in half. And you break it in half, and break it in half, and break it in half. When you break something, it like collapses. When you light something on fire, it collapses. Collapses. It breaks things apart. Fire breaks things apart. What does water do? Take flour. Flour is comprised of individual tiny specks, right? Tiny individual pieces. Hey guys. So, flour is comprised of tiny pieces. You take water and you mix it with flour. What happens now to the flour? Help me out here.
Sticks together.
It unites. Mazel tov. We now have, from all of these different pieces, specks of flour, we now have a unified mass, which we'll call dough. Right? It's now a thing. Water combines. Fire divides. Water unifies. Fire diversifies. That's the way it is. Fire breaks things down to their original elements. Kabbalah says that everything that exists is comprised of different elements. And all of the elements join together and combine in a way to form structure. When you take something, you light it on fire, fire destroys the structure that binds things together, and it reduces everything to its elemental, to its basic pieces, devoid of that structure. Fire breaks down structure. Fire divides. Water unites and joins things together. Of course, your mileage may vary. You can use fire to cook and bring things together, right? You can take water and pour it on something to make things split apart. But in general, water unites and fire divides. That's the way it works. Now, how do these exceptions work that I mentioned? If you look at it carefully, you might see some fire in the water and some water in the fire, but that's for another discussion. But in general, water unites and fire divides, like the mind. Kabbalah says the mind, the brain, the nature of the brain is that it is wet. And the heart is fire. The mind is water, and the heart is fire. That's what it says in Kabbalah. The mind is water. What does that mean? It doesn't mean the brain is moist. Might also be true. But I'm sure the brain, without getting too gross here, I'm sure the brain is hot, right? Inside the body, I'm sure it's not cold. Although Kabbalah says it's cold and wet. The brain, the mind is cold and wet. What does it mean, cold and wet? Not physically. Not only physically. It means concept. It's cold and wet. Cold means calculated, objective, dispassionate. It sees things the way it is, not the way I am. The way it is. It's cold. It's disconnected almost. It's objective. And it's wet. It can bring opposites together. Because the mind is objective, I can understand conflicting ideas, or I can have conflicting understandings of the same idea, and it's okay. It's okay. Because in the mind, in theory, why not? Why not have diversity? I can understand a topic this way, and I can understand the topic that way. I can study a piece of Talmud, and I can read Rashi's commentary, and I can say, that makes a lot of sense. And then I read Tosfot's commentary. That also makes a lot of sense. Can I not sleep at night because I have two different ways of looking at something? Of course not. I understand there's two ways of looking at something. You can look at it this way, you can look at it that way. I can study a third commentary and a fourth commentary and a fifth commentary, and I can understand five different ways of understanding the same piece of Talmud. And you know what? That's great. The more the merrier. Bring it on. I love it. You know why? Because the mind is all about unity. The more the merrier. It's objective and it binds together. So give me this idea, give me that idea, and I'll tell you, you know what? Maybe I can draw a connection between the two, although it seems to be different. At its core, it's connected. Whatever it is, the mind revels in this stuff. The mind loves it. The heart. Oh, no way. This is my feeling on it. Don't tell me how you feel. I'm going to tell you how I feel. You want to share your feelings? Have I told you how I feel? The heart doesn't tolerate opposites. The heart fights opposites. The heart is subjective. The heart is, this is how I feel. So the heart is dry and hot. It's like fire. It splits up things. Yeah?
Could you say that the heart then is egotistic?
The heart is subjective. The heart is very much I. Yes. Yes.
And I mean, ultimately, if it's we're about getting away from ego.
Well, here's the thing. There are a lot of advantages, as I said at the beginning of the class. There are a lot of advantages in the heart in that subjectivity, because at the end of the day, God created us as individuals, as an I. In other words, the ego does have a virtue. The purpose of life, as Kabbalah explains it, as you know, is not only getting away from ego, but realizing something higher within our individual ego. It's not about destroying self, but it's about lifting up self. So really it's about combining the positives of both and trying to weed out the negatives of both. But what I'm trying to do this morning is really present in stark contrast the difference between the mind and the heart, just so we have a better understanding of these topics, which leads directly into our discussion today inside the text. So the mind is objective. The heart is subjective. The mind is unifying. The mind tolerates diversity. You study a verse in the Torah. You study a biblical verse. And again, like I mentioned with the Talmudic example, you have this commentary and that commentary and another commentary, and it's wonderful. We say there's an expression, Shivim Panim LaTorah. There are 70 faces to the Torah, 70 facets to Torah study. Like a diamond, like a jewel that you hold up, and every time, as you turn it, it sparkles, it shines, it refracts light in a different way. Every time you look at a verse, you study a piece of the Torah, you look at it this way, you look at it that way, you look at it this way, you look at it that way, and it's refracting light. It has all these different interpretations. And the mind loves it. The mind loves it because the mind, which is objective, can tolerate opposites. The heart, which is subjective, the heart does not do well with opposites, with contradictions. The heart says, it's my way or the highway. The mind says, let me understand your opinion and let me share with you my opinion and I can understand both ways of seeing things, etc. Sometimes, people that would put themselves in a more, or that could be classified more as intellectuals, sometimes, they are, sometimes, it might be harder to make a decision. The more intellectual, the more in your head you are, the harder it might be to make a decision. Why? Because you understand all the sides so well. The better you understand this way, and that way, and the other way, and the pros and the cons, which job should I take? I have this job, and this is these advantages. This job has those advantages. Now what? The more you're in your head, the less you're able to actually make a decision.
What do you do?
Take the money and run. Get out of your head sometimes. That's why you need the heart.
Go where you got.
Sometimes you need the heart. The heart, which is subjective, allows you to have an opinion and to have a feeling about it. That's subjective, that's not objective. Objectivity, you can get lost in the ideas about something. Oh, this looks great, that looks great, it all looks great. Now I'm stuck. The heart takes a position. The heart takes a stance. I like this, I don't like that. I understand both, but this is what I like. I understand that you like this, and that you like that, and that you like the other. I understand these pros and those cons, but this is what I like. The heart gives us our individuality. I am not necessarily saying we should always follow our heart. You can't make decisions from an intellectual place. I'm not saying, you know, 100% either way. But in general, the mind is more about objectivity and inclusiveness. And the heart is more about subjectivity and division, separation. Make sense so far? Okay, so let's connect it with numerology. Last time on Kabbalah and Coffee, we spoke about Ayek Bechar. Remember that? Ayek Bechar? What is Ayek Bechar? Three Hebrew letters, six Hebrew letters. Aleph, Yod, Kuf is Ayek. Bechar is Bet, Chaf, Resh. So every Hebrew letter corresponds to a number. This is the secret of Gematria, a.k.a. Hebrew numerology. Every Hebrew letter corresponds to a number. Beginning with the first letter, the letter Aleph, which corresponds to 1. The letter Bet, the second letter, corresponds to 2. Gimel, the third letter, corresponds to 3, so on and so forth, through the 9th letter, and then the 10th letter. The 11th letter does not correspond to 11 in this system, in the normative system of Gematria. There are different systems, by the way, you should know, of Gematria. But in the normative system of Gematria, the 11th letter corresponds to 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, 200, 300, 400. This is the normative system of Hebrew numerology. So the letters Ayik, Aleph, Yod, Kuf, correspond to the numbers 1, 10, and 100. 1, 10, and 100. Single digits, double digits, triple digits, all in the 1 family. So it's 1 without any zeros, 1 with 1 zero, 10, and 1 with 2 zeros, which is 100. Bet, Chaf, and Resh. 2, 20, and 200. 2 single digits, 20 double digits, 200 triple digits. The point is that each number, 1, 2, 3, can exist in 1-digit form, 2-digit form, 3-digit form, and as we said last week in the text, it can also exist in 4-digit form and 5-digit form, and then it gets Kabbalistically maxed out in the 10,000s. So again, 1, 10, 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, 2, 20, 200, 2,000, 20,000, 3, 30, 300, 3,000, 30,000, etc. That's the system that Kabbalah sets forth regarding numbers, or one of the systems that it sets forth regarding the numbers. And as we said last week in the text, these digits, single digits, double digits, triple digits, 4 digits, 5 digits, correspond to 5 dimensions within creation, and 5 dimensions within the human soul. To understand what these dimensions are within the human soul, we're going to take a case study and look at the life of our matriarch, Sarah. Sarah was the wife of Abraham, and together they are the first Jewish couple. Abraham and Sarah, Avram and Sarah. And the Torah talks about the passing of Sarah in the book of Genesis. And I mentioned this at the end, tail end of last week's class. The Torah talks about her life in a very interesting way when it enumerates the length of her years, how many years she lived. Let's pick up the discussion in the book, or in the handout, on page number 34. Let's begin on 34. Again, just so you understand where we're at. We're using the life of Sarah as a case study to see the distinction between single digits, double digits, triple digits, four digits, and five digits. And all of this will reconnect with what I said before about emotions and intellect. And we'll see this binding, these two ideas come together in just a moment. Let's begin top of page 34. To explain. It is written, the life of Sarah was 100 year, 20 year, and 70 years. And I said it differently than it's written here. The reason why I said it differently, I used year and year and then years, is because in the Hebrew, that's the way it's written. It says, the Torah says, the life of Sarah. Sarah passed away. How old was she when she passed away? 127. The Torah does not say that she was 127 years old. It says that she lived 100 year, 20 year, and 7 years. Mea shana, 100 year. Esrim shana, 20 year, visheva shanim, and 7 years. The question is, number one, why does the Torah split up the 100 from the 20 from the 7? Number two, what is the significance of the numbers 100, 20, and 7? Number three, third question, why is it that when it comes to the 100 and the 20, why does it use the singular term shana, which means year? And when it comes to the 7, which is the smallest unit, it uses the plural, shanim, years. You with me on all these questions? I'll recap them one more time. These are my questions. But these are questions that the discourse addresses. Question number one, why does the Torah not simply say she lived 127 years? Instead, it says 100, 20, and 7. Each time interspersed by the word shana, years. Shana. Question number one. Question number two. What is the significance of the numbers of the year of her years of her life? 127. What's the mystical significance of those amounts? And number three, why does it say for the first two segments that are distinguished, why does it say shana, year in the singular, and then by the third, smallest unit of seven, does it say shanim, years, in the plural? Questions make sense? Those are the three questions. So to explain this, the discourse quotes the Zohar. The Zohar is one of the fundamental and primary Kabbalistic texts, and it is one of the most difficult to understand. And today we're going to cite the Zohar and explain it. So, but first, the words of the Zohar. This is the third paragraph, the first big paragraph on page 34. The Zohar explains, here we go, here's the quote. 100 years, the Holy One is united in the supernal place, which is most hidden, the level of 100, in the secret of 100 daily blessings. Likewise, regarding the level of 20 years, and therefore, the word year appears in the singular, alluding to the unity of thought and jubilee that are not separated. So far, so good? Makes sense? Total sense, right? Okay. The 7 years, however, are divided into the categories of judgment and mercy, hence the use of shanim, years, in the plural, and not shana, year, in the singular. That's the end of the quote from the Zohar. What the Zohar is saying, basically, is that there's significance in the fact that the Torah uses the singular term shana, which means year, when it comes to the segments of 120, because 120 represent higher mystical spiritual realms that are in a state of essential unification and unity, whereas the lowest state, the lowest dimension, which is the dimension of 7, is in a state of diversity, which is why the Torah uses the plural shanim when it comes to the 7. Does that make sense? We haven't yet explained it and put labels on it, but that's the outline of what the Zohar is saying. The level of 100 is lofty, and it's a level of unification. Everything in 100 is all together. Therefore, it's singular, shana, one. It's one unit of 100 because the 100 is unified. Likewise, 20. 20 is 20, but 20 is a level that's unified, so therefore it's one dimension of 20. 7. 7 is not unified. 7 is diverse. And therefore, although it's only 7 and not 20 or 100, which are bigger numbers, but the 7 split up, therefore shanim, it's in the plural. So what's 7, what's 20, and what's 100? Here we go. Let's get into it. This now brings us back to emotions and intellect. By the way, how many emotional attributes did I tell you we possess?
Seven.
What was that?
Seven.
Well, you probably already see the answer to why it says 7 years in the plural, which means diversity and plurality. What's diverse about seven? The emotions are diverse. Okay? Here we go. Let's jump in. In human terms, the 7 years refers to the 7 emotional attributes, which are generally divided into chesed, which is loving kindness, and gevurah, which is severity and discipline, which are the 2 primary emotional dispositions that I mentioned before in the introduction. Remember I gave you an example of parents, 2 parents. One parent is very loving. I'll give you whatever you want. And the other parent is very much about discipline and rules and guidelines and consequences, right? Chesed, Gvura, 2 different dispositions. Without the mind bringing them together, they themselves, the emotional dispositions, are diverse. They're fragmented. They're disparate. They are distinct. They are 7 years in the plural. Does that make sense? Yes? Here we go. To highlight the power of the emotions to influence not only how we feel, but even influencing how we think. Remember I told you before all the way at the beginning of the class that not only is your heart subjective, but it can also make your mind subjective, so that you start seeing things colored, flavored, jaded, influenced, biased by your heart. To highlight that point, the discourse brings the next paragraph. This division is also the source of the differing opinions of Beit Shammai, whose souls are rooted in Gevurah and are therefore more stringent in their rulings, and Beit Hillel, whose souls are rooted in Chesed and are therefore more lenient in their rulings. The discourse cites 2 of the most famous Jewish scholars of the Mishnah and the Talmud, Hillel and Shammai. Each of them started an academy. They had their own Talmudic academy, Jewish Academy. One was the Academy of Hillel, and one was the Academy of Shammai, a.k.a. Beit Hillel. Beit means the house of, but it means not like where he lived, his academy, his building, his school. The house of Hillel and the house of Shammai. Each of them founded an academy. Hillel's academy was founded upon his way of thinking. Shammai's academy was founded upon his way of thinking. When you look through the Talmud and you look at their disputes, you notice patterns. There are hundreds of disputes between the Academy of Shammai and the Academy of Hillel. And when you look at each case, it boils, typically with very, very few exceptions, it boils down to one central idea. Beit Shammai, the Academy of Shammai, is taking a stricter approach. They're more strict, they're more stringent, tougher. Beit Hillel is taking the more lenient approach, kind, compassionate, forgiving. Typically, that's the way, in the hundreds of disputes, that's the way, that's the dividing line between the 2 opinions, which are reflected in the ways that they live their own lives. Famously, the Talmud tells a story about a fellow who was exploring Judaism for the first time. He wanted to learn about Judaism. He didn't grow up Jewish, and he wanted to know, what is Judaism? So he goes to Shammai, not the academy, but the person. He goes to Shammai and he says, Shammai, teach me Judaism. Teach me Torah on one foot. Give me the basics. You know, give me the short version. Shammai says, how dare you insult Torah by trying to have me reduce it to one idea. Get out of here. And he chases him away. The same fellow went to Hillel, the person. And he said to Hillel, teach me Torah on one foot. And Hillel famously said, what you don't like, don't do to your fellow. This is the whole Torah. The rest is commentary. Now go learn. And the Talmud says that this man was so inspired by Hillel's love and embrace and wisdom and encouragement and whatever, that he did study, he did convert to Judaism, and he lived happily ever after. But the Talmud tells us and highlights the different reactions of Shammai and Hillel. Shammai says, how dare you? Get out of here. Hillel says, come on in. Let me tell you what's going on. Totally different. Shammai was Gvura, disciplinarian. Here are the rules. Here are the guidelines. You don't make a mockery of Torah. Torah is bigger than you standing on one foot. Don't tell me, challenge me. Can you encapsulate Torah on one foot while I'm standing on one foot? Seriously? Come on. It's not a joke. This is rigorous study. Years of study. Come back later. He chased him away, the Talmud says, with a ruler. It says with a building measuring stick, which I'm assuming is a ruler. Chased him away. Yeah, he took a stick and And Hillel's chesed. Hillel says, Hillel's loving kindness, embracing. Hillel says, I see what you want. I see what you need. Let me share with you something that will uplift you and inspire you and encourage you to stay on this journey. And that's what happened. And it played out that way. So the academy that Hillel founded was in his image. And their rulings were more lenient. And the Academy of Shammai, their rulings were more stringent. And by the way, you had different opinions, but there's only one way that Jewish law can go. What's the halacha? The halacha follows. Halacha is the final decision on Jewish law. It always follows Hillel, the Academy of Hillel. That's the way it works. It does not follow, with very few exceptions. There are very few exceptions where the halacha, where the law follows Shammai, but otherwise it follows Hillel, the Academy of Hillel, which, you know, might tell us, if we had to err on either side of the emotional divide, which one is, you know, which one we should fall on. But anyway, that's not germane to the discussion. The point over here is, Kabbalah says, why is it that Hillel was more lenient, Shammai was more strict? It has to do with where their souls came from. In other words, every soul comes from God. And God has all seven attributes. But what it means is, within the source, there might be different chambers. Which chamber does this come from? You know, which chamber? Hillel's soul came from the chamber of Chesed. Shammai's soul came from the chamber of Gvura. So Hillel is more chesed, kindness. Shammai is more gvura, discipline. It plays out in how they see things, how they see the world, how they react to the world, how they understand Torah itself. When it comes to a question of Jewish law, Hillel says, this is how I understand it in my mind, but it's influenced by his emotional and spiritual disposition. Does it make sense? In other words, his subjectivity, Hillel's, toward chesed, loving kindness, influences his objective mind so that he sees and understands things in a way that's leaning toward chesed leniency. Shammai's soul is rooted in the chamber of gvura, discipline, and strictness. And that influences his emotional disposition, which therefore influences his mind and his objective way of understanding, so that he objectively sees things filtered through the lens of Gvura.
Could you say that in a sense that Hillel's soul is more brings it more unified than the Gvura? Because Gvura then is black and white, and Hillel is more
100%.
He sees the whole picture.
Yeah, that's why Hillel was more welcoming on a practical level to people. There was a fellow who took a bet with his friends at the bar, and he said, "I can make Hillel mad." And they said, "No, you can't. He doesn't get mad." And he said, "Watch, I'll get him mad." Talmud says he went to Hillel right before Shabbat. Hillel was getting ready, you know, getting bathed and dressed for Shabbat, and he goes to Hillel and he says, "Hillel," knocks on the door. "Hillel, does Hillel live here?" And Hillel comes out. Hillel comes. No worries. Hillel comes out. And Hillel says, "Yes, can I help you?" He gets dressed. You know, he's like in the middle of dress, but he puts on something. He gets dressed and he says, "You know, can I help you?" Man says, "Yeah. Why are the, I don't remember what it was." He started asking about different people. "Why are these people's heads round? Why are these," he starts asking about like totally random questions that like have no, certainly not something that Hillel should be asked or answered, or he should answer. He starts asking Hillel a random question. Hillel gives him a respectful answer, and he goes on his way. He gets back to whatever, getting ready for Shabbat. Hillel, again, he's harassing. What? He comes down, he gets dressed again, comes down. Yes, he asks another random question. It happens 3 or 4 times. Finally, you know, and every time he answers him patiently and with love and acceptance. And eventually he comes clean to Hillel. He says, "Hillel, you know, because of you I just lost..." He says, "Hillel, may there not be many like you." He said, "Why?" He said, because of you I lost a lot of money on a bet." He said, "What was the bet?" "I bet that I could make you upset." He said, "Fine, I'd rather you lose money than me getting upset." But that was his disposition. He was an embracer. He was that guy. Shammai, not necessarily. But the point is, there are different emotional dispositions, and within emotions, there's diversity. It can also influence the decisions that we make in life, but it all stems from the emotional distinction. Because in its pure state, the mind is objective. When it's influenced by the heart, it's not. There are 7 emotional dispositions, not just 2, kindness and discipline. There are 7. But the 2 are primary, and therefore we're discussing them. Page 36, let's turn to 36. The plural form years is therefore employed, alluding to this division and the diversity. In other words, when the Torah talks about the life of Sarah, the Torah says she lived 100 year, 20 year, and 7 years. Why 7 years? Because 7, single digits. This is how we're connecting everything. The single digits, you have triple digits, 100, double digits, 20, single digits, 7. 7 single digits are the level of emotions. Although they're single digits, they're diverse because they're distinct, because they are so subjective. So each one of the 7 is different than the other. Therefore, it says shanim, plural years. Make sense? Let's go on to 20. No. She passed away at 127.
Okay, so chronologically she was 127, but that number has significance. That's what you're trying to say.
What I'm saying is the way the Torah states her age is very unique and frankly strange.
Okay, so
the Torah, one second. The Torah says she lived 100 year, 20 year, and 7 years. Now, you and I would never say that. How old are you? 100 year, 20 year, and 7 years. I mean, first of all, please God, we should all live to 127 and pass. But we would never say that. You would say, "I'm 127 years old." No one would ever say, "I'm 100 year, 20 year, and 7 years." Number one, you would never divide into 3. And number two, why would you say year, year, and then years? So again, Kabbalistically, this has significance. Kabbalah says that it's not just a particular age of Sarah, but it also defines and describes the human condition, and it explains the framework, the spiritual framework of existence, and that is that there are different dimensions. There's triple-digit dimension, double-digit dimension, single-digit dimension. The single-digit dimension is plurality because it's emotions which are in a state of divisiveness. Now, no problem. 36, second section where it says only a tenth. These emotional attributes correspond to single digits. As I just said, the single digits are seven. Seven is within the single digit category. There's seven, so it's single digits. But again, the interesting reality, I don't know if it's a paradox, but it's single digits, but the single digits have plurality because each of the emotions are distinct from the other because emotions are so subjective. In contradistinction to the intellectual attributes, which correspond to double digits, namely the number 20. Why double digits? Because there are two primary intellectual attributes, chachma and bina, which is wisdom and understanding. Each one, since the intellectual attributes are inclusive, each one includes all 10 of the human dispositions, intellect and emotions. So each one includes the other 9. So each one is really a segment of 10. 10 of Chachma, 10 of Bina, 10 times 2 is, of course, 20. Those are the 20 year of Sarah's life. Again, the 20 year of Sarah.
Say it again, slower.
I wanted to say it fast. It was so much fun saying it fast. Okay. One second. Hold on. The intellectual attributes are objective. And one mark of objectivity, we said before, is that they are inclusive. There are 10 human dispositions in total. 3 intellectual, 7 emotional, 10 in total. But because the intellect is inclusive, each intellectual attribute is not just one, it's all 10. Why is it's all 10. Why is it all 10? It's all 10 because it's so inclusive. In other words, if it's one, it would mean it's diverse. It's not diverse. It is all inclusive. There are two primary intellectual attributes, chachma and bina. That is a hybrid between the mind and the heart. Therefore, it's more of a bridge between intellect and emotions. So therefore, it's not pure intellect. It's kind of intellect trained toward emotion. Pure intellect is chachma and bina. There's two of them. Each of the two, we said, is inclusive and therefore has all 10 dispositions inside of it. Therefore, you have 10 times 2, that's your 20. And it's 20, not years, plurality. It's 20 year because there's unification in the context of the intellectual attributes of chachma and bina because they bring everything together. Let's bridge the gap between the diversity, let's unify things. Therefore, there is the 20 and year in the singular. So let's read this inside. This is all inside, but let's just read it inside. This is because... Now we're getting to another detail here. Okay, this is because the stimulation of the emotions is only from 1/10 of the intellect. Why is it that intellect is single digits and emotions are double digits? Because the emotions are only drawing from 1/10 of the energy of the intellectual attributes. For the intellect in its entirety does not extend to the emotions, only the lowest level of the intellect vests itself in the emotions. In other words, intellect is on a higher dimension than emotions. It doesn't mean it's better. There are advantages to the emotions that are on that drill down individual personal level, as I said before and we've said several times. Nonetheless, the intellect itself stands on a higher dimension than the emotions. The emotions are deemed to be only 1/10 of the intellect in that it's only a little bit of the intellect that fuels the emotion. Once the emotion gets it, it drives on its own almost with a little bit of residual intellect, but it itself has its own reality that then takes it where it goes. So there's a little bit of idea, there's some mindfulness that fuels the emotion, but it's only considered like 1/10 of the intellect. It's really now in an emotional level. So individual emotional attributes are therefore called shana, 1 year, i.e. 1/10 of the intellect. Collectively, let's continue. The intellectual faculties are called 20 year. I don't know why it's translated here as years. It's 20 year. In addition, the singular term shana, year, is used because the two intellectual faculties of Chachma and Bina, each of which individually correspond to the number 10, are two friends which never part, united in an eternal bond. Chachma and Bina, which are the two intellectual faculties, are not just united because intellect is always united, but because Chachma and Bina and their interplay with each other, although they're two different intellectual attributes, unlike love and discipline, Chachma and Bina, wisdom and understanding, actually work together. Pure love and pure discipline don't work together, they work against each other. But Chachma and Bina, wisdom and understanding, they do work together. Wisdom, Chachma, is the core of the idea, and Bina is fleshing it out. Those two absolutely work together. When you flesh out an idea, what are you fleshing out? The core of the idea. And the more you flesh it out, the more you understand the core. And you can't flesh something out unless you have the core of the idea. In other words, Chachma and Bina are really part of the same entity of understanding. Therefore, there's a total synthesis of Chachma and Bina, which is why you get 20 year. They're two friends, Trey-Ray and Delay-Sparshan. What's the language? Trey-Ray. They're two friends which never part, united in eternal bond, hence the use of the singular Shana.
So Shana is...
singular.
...is collectively Bina and...
Chachma and Bina, exactly.
Okay.
We can explain...
Dot.
Yeah.
D-O...
D-A-A-T. We can explain the unity of Chachma and Bina with an example from the human mind. We'll close out in just a moment. We can explain the unity of Chachma and Bina with an example from the human mind. When one understands a halachic concept, a concept in Jewish law, both Bina and Chachma are invariably involved in the process. The comprehension is the Bina, and it understands the essence of the concept, which is Chachma. Your Bina is the understanding, but what it understands is the concept, which is Chachma. In other words, Chachma is the concept. Bina is the understanding of the concept. So they're working together. The mind, intellect, is unified. It unifies things together, and its different capacities, its different functions are also unified, and they work together. Unlike the heart. The heart is distinct. My heart is different than your heart. That makes me an individual and you an individual. And within my own heart, my individual emotional dispositions work against each other. When I feel love, I don't feel discipline. When I feel discipline, I don't feel love. They're standoffish within my own heart. Whereas within my own mind, my attribute of Chachma, which is the core of the idea, and my attribute of Bina, which is understanding and fleshing out that idea, they work hand in hand like a glove in perfect unity. And we'll have to stop here. Bottom of 36. Top of 38, yeah, we're not yet to 38, but bottom of 36, we're going to get into 38 next week, please God, where we'll talk about what exists beyond the intellect, what transcends intelligence. That's the next conversation. We'll get into transcendence of intellect. We'll get into what's called ratzon, which is will, and chefetz, which is desire. We'll get into all of that next week. In other words, what we're trying to do here is understand the different digits. Single digits are emotions. Double digits are intellect. Triple digits transcend intellect. Four digits, will. Five digits, desire. These correspond to the five dimensions of the soul. These correspond to five digits embedded in the fabric of math and creation, the Kabbalah of numbers. And these five digits correspond to how we can live a more meaningful and focused life. Thank you very much for joining me today for Kabbalah and Coffee.